From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Wisconsin's new Attorney General Josh Call talks about his priorities for the next 4 years and the restrictions on his office the Republican-led legislature passed in the lame duck session.
There is a lot of room to work across the aisle on some of these important public safety issues, and so I'm hoping that we'll be able to work together to make progress on behalf of Wisconsinites.
Later, we'll learn about a unique student-run publishing house that's been operating for more than 30 years at UW-Stevens Point.
And singer and Wauwatosa native Grace Weber talks about coming to terms with a pretty amazing development, a contract with Capitol Records.
The Capitol thing helps me recalibrate it, too, in a way of like, you know what, let me just enjoy this for a second. And my album is done, so I've been enjoying that and really, like, enjoying the moment, which sounds cliche, but hey, it's the truth.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Josh Call was sworn in as Wisconsin's new attorney general on Monday. In the coming days, he'll be getting the lay of the land in his new position and also dealing with the ramifications of the Wisconsin legislature's extraordinary lame duck session.
Republican lawmakers stripped powers from Governor Tony Evers and also from Call as attorney general, including by giving lawmakers power over spending settlement money and over withdrawing from lawsuits challenging federal policy.
Ahead of his inauguration, Call spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver about the extraordinary session and about his initial goals going forward.
So my top priority as Attorney General is going to be working on public safety. There are some really important public safety issues where I think there's significant progress to be made. One of them is our opioid epidemic. The number of opioid-related overdose deaths went up in 2017 compared to the prior year. And we need to start responding to that epidemic like the crisis it is. And so I'm hoping to work with the legislature to keep working to expand access to substance abuse treatment. I'm looking forward to working to ensure that pharmaceutical companies are held accountable for their role in the epidemic. And I also think we need to ensure that our enforcement efforts are targeting large-scale drug traffickers. But I also think there are other really important public safety issues where we need to make progress, including making our schools safer. I'd like to see Wisconsin enact a red flag law, universal background checks, and I think we need long-term funding for mental health programs in schools. And then when it comes to Wisconsin's backlog of untested rape kits, now that kits have been tested, we need to ensure that where there is a DNA match, that those cases are fully and thoroughly investigated. And I hope to work with the legislature to pass legislation that will prevent there from being another backlog of untested rape kits in the state.
Do you think that any of those priorities, you know, that you won't be able to work on them in the same way given the, what happened in the lame duck session?
One of the things that happened as a result of the lame duck session is that some resources have been taken away from the Department of Justice. I'm hoping that the legislature restores those resources in the upcoming budget. But my approach is going to be to reach out to members of the legislature. I think there is a lot of room to work across the aisle on some of these important public safety issues. And so I'm hoping that we'll be able to work together to make progress on behalf of Wisconsinites.
What do you see as the biggest obstacle with the lame duck session? I mean, there were many components. One of them was that they made lawmakers in charge of the litigation that Wisconsin can go into. How will that affect your strategy going forward on those types of cases?
Yeah, so one problem, as I mentioned, is the resources being taken away from the Department of Justice, which, you know, I think is not in the interest of public safety. But also some of the changes that the legislature has made will make the process of resolving cases more difficult than it had been. And so I think it's going to slow the process down and make our process less efficient. And then on, you know, there is virtually certain to be litigation relating to this extraordinary session. And what that's going to mean is that we're going to have to devote time and resources to litigation over the authority of the Attorney General's office and the governor's office, instead of being able to focus completely on working to address the problems that face Wisconsinites, which is where our focus should be.
So in layman's terms, for people who may not know what the DOJ does every day, what are some of these resources? Like, what is going to be the concrete effect of the lame duck session on the day-to-day function of the DOJ?
One of the changes that the legislature made was that it eliminated the office of the Solicitor General. It took away four lawyer positions at the Department of Justice. And that office has worked on some high-profile cases, including cases that went before the U.S. Supreme Court. And I actually would have sought to reduce the size of that office myself. But, you know, other lawyers will now need to be replacing the work that that office would have done. That's just one example. But DOJ plays a really important role on public safety issues. It oversees training and standards for law enforcement around the state. It handles criminal appeals. It runs the Office of Crime Victim Services, the Office of School Safety, and there's a Division of Criminal Investigation at the Department of Justice. So it plays an important role in public safety. It also enforces environmental and consumer protection laws. So it's an agency with some really important functions, and I don't think taking resources away from it is in the public's interest.
And the resources that you're specifically talking about are the Solicitor General's office. Anything else?
That's one area. There's also been a change to certain appropriations. They've been changed from continuing appropriations to annual appropriations. And the effect of that will likely be some reduction in resources for the department. And then the way that settlement funds are handled has been changed so that money is going to be going to the general fund rather than to the Department of Justice. So what I'm hoping is that we'll be able to work with the legislature either to reverse some of those changes or to ensure that additional funding is provided to make up for the funding that's been lost as a result of these changes.
So that means, like, if Wisconsin wins a lawsuit and ends up getting money, instead of the DOJ or you as Attorney General deciding how to spend the money, the legislature will decide how to spend the money?
Generally speaking, that's right, yes.
So one of the things that the department is able to do has been, historically, has been able to decide what sort of federal litigation to get into. And you ran on the position of withdrawing from the lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. That lawsuit has been decided. So what will Wisconsin's involvement be in the federal appellate courts if a challenge is brought?
So what the legislature has done, one of the things it's done with the extraordinary session legislation is it has moved power from the governor to authorize the withdrawal of Wisconsin from a lawsuit challenging a policy of the federal government. It's moved that power to the legislature and specifically to the Joint Finance Committee in the legislature. And so what that means now is that Wisconsin, to withdraw from a lawsuit, the AG would need to get approval from that committee under the extraordinary session law. As you mentioned, one of the issues that both Governor-elect Evers and I campaigned on was withdrawing Wisconsin from that lawsuit. And so the result of this has been to make it so that Governor Evers is unable to fulfill that campaign promise. Now, instead, it's the Joint Finance Committee that will decide whether the state of Wisconsin withdraws from the suit. And so going forward, the process will be that committee gets to decide whether DOJ withdraws. Now, in terms of that suit, what's happened is that the district court has issued a ruling finding that the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional, but that decision has been stayed, which means it's not going to go into effect yet, pending appeal. So the next stage in that case will be an appeal. And how Wisconsin handles that will depend on what happens going forward, between the AG's office and the Joint Finance Committee.
Well, the other thing is, in the extraordinary session, they did not pass a law covering people with pre-existing conditions in the state of Wisconsin. What are the steps forward on that aspect of covering Wisconsinites with pre-existing conditions if the Affordable Care Act is deemed unconstitutional ultimately?
Yeah, you're right about that. So one of the implications of this lawsuit, if it's successful, the lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act, is that the guarantee that people with pre-existing conditions won't be discriminated against would be eliminated. although that's not the only effect. This suit, if it's successful, would also eliminate the requirement that insurance companies provide coverage to young adults, allow them to stay on their parents' coverage until they're 26. And so if the Affordable Care Act is struck down, those provisions will be eliminated along with other protections. So for Wisconsin to provide protection, it's going to, if it wants to provide protection for people with a pre-existing condition, and I certainly hope that our legislature does, it's going to need to pass legislation that does provide those protections.
And do you see that the Attorney General has a role in getting that sort of legislation off the ground?
I think the Attorney General's role is to talk about what's going to happen if this lawsuit is successful, what the implications are. You know, I think it is in the interest of the state to have protection for Wisconsinites with a pre-existing condition for a lot of reasons. It's just the right thing to do. And so I'm hopeful that the legislature will pass those protections. But, you know, ultimately, that's going to be a decision that the legislature makes in the upcoming session.
Do you see optimism given the fact that they weren't able to do it in the extraordinary session?
I'm hopeful that the legislature will be able to pass something. And I'm hopeful that what is passed will have the same kind of strong protections that the Affordable Care Act has. And so, you know, we'll see. I'm hopeful that members of the legislature will be able to work together and work across the aisle to get something enacted.
Do you foresee being able to work with the legislature, even given the fact that they went into this extraordinary session and essentially stripped powers from the incoming attorney general, yourself, and the incoming governor?
I do. I intend to reach out and work with legislators of either party on issues where we have agreement. And I think there are issues where we can work together and where there's significant agreement, including some issues related to public safety. So I'm hoping to move forward and to get as much progress made as we can for Wisconsinites.
You have said in the past that you believe in defending state law if there is a colorable basis for it. Do you anticipate defending the laws that were passed in the extraordinary session?
I'm not going to comment on the position that the Department of Justice will take in that litigation until I'm in office as Attorney General and I'm able to work with the attorneys at the Department of Justice on these issues. But I think it's clear that there are issues that this legislation raises that present significant constitutional issues. You know, our Constitution is structured so that powers are separated. There's a separation of powers between the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. And resolution of a lawsuit is, an action that seems to be a fairly classic executive branch function. But the legislature has given itself control over that function as a result of this legislation. So there are some potentially significant challenges that can be brought, and we'll address that once I'm in office as Attorney General.
And then a few of the other things that were addressed in the extraordinary session, early voting was limited. Do you anticipate that is something that the Attorney General's office would get involved with?
So there's an ongoing suit related to that issue, and that is one that I'm going to be recused from as Attorney General because of my work in connection with that case as an attorney in private practice. And so I will personally be recused from that, and so that decision will ultimately not be that case won't be handled by me. It will be handled by others in the Department of Justice.
And then there was also legislation that had to do with making it easier for essentially lawmakers to have an intervener status or to be able to intervene in litigation that the Attorney General's office is being involved. If I am not mistaken, there was intervener status before for various parties. How has the extraordinary session changed that? Has it made anything much different?
So previously, the legislature, to intervene in a case, would have to file a motion with a court seeking to intervene. And what this legislation does is it gives both the Assembly and the Senate and then certain committees a right to intervene. In federal court, ultimately, it would be up to the federal courts to decide whether to allow that intervention regardless. But in state courts, this would give those different committees and the houses of the legislature a right to intervene. But you're right. Before, the legislature or members of the legislature or committees could have sought to intervene in cases. And so what this does is it gives them a right in state courts. And what that means is that there's going to be, assuming that this right is used, there's going to be more money spent by the state on lawyers in these cases, where we will have both lawyers for the Department of Justice and also lawyers on behalf of the legislature who are both involved in these cases. It's going to make the process.
So in a nutshell, given the extraordinary session, will your approach be different going into the next few months of 2019?
The approach that I'm going to take in terms of addressing issues and doing what we can to make progress is going to be exactly the same. I'm going to work where I can across the aisle, work with the legislature to try to enact legislation that's going to be helpful for Wisconsinites, and the Department of Justice will fairly and even-handedly be enforcing our laws. But one of the products of this is that there are new complications. Just settling certain lawsuits is going to be more difficult. There's likely to be litigation. So what this is going to mean is that there's going to be some diversion of resources that I think is unnecessary and unfortunate, but that is going to be a byproduct of this legislation.
Thank you so much, Josh Call.
Thank you.
Josh Call took office yesterday as Wisconsin's new attorney general. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver, and you can read more about him at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then the story of Wisconsin's only university student-run publishing house. This is Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Last month, we spoke with Wisconsin writer Kim Soor about her new short story collection called Nothing to Lose. It's Soor's first published book of fiction, and while that's a story, its publisher is a story itself.
Earlier last year, leaders at UW-Stevens Point proposed eliminating more than a dozen humanities programs at the school. That plan was scaled back in the fall to just 6 programs. Advocates of the cut say they're needed to both address a budget crunch, but also to better reflect the needs of central Wisconsin, specifically in areas such as career training.
But critics point to humanities programs that already exist at the school, such as the aforementioned publisher, Cornerstone Press, a working publishing house managed by UW-Stevens Point students. While we spoke with Kim Soor in studio, we were joined via Skype by Ross Tangadal, an English professor and director of Cornerstone Press, and by Monica Swinnick, editor-in-chief, Maddie Swanger, the director of operations, and Katie Nachampasak, the press's chief of staff. Tangadal explained how the work on Soor's book is representative of how Cornerstone operates.
What's interesting about the press is that we're staffed entirely by students. We do have an administrative team, myself, another professor, and an alumnus of the university. She's our development coordinator. So we're kind of restructuring to become more like a legitimate small press, Gray Wolf and Coffee House in Minneapolis, presses like that. And Kim's book really fits into that new kind of model. So we have 40 to 50 manuscripts submitted to our press throughout the year. That means that our entire staff vets a significant amount of those manuscripts. Now, they don't read them entirely. They read cover letters, query letters, selections. We actually have Maddie, who's with us today as well, was our acquisitions intern a month before the course began. That staffs the press. So she was able to vet all 46 manuscripts pretty significantly and give direction to the staff then once they got their hands on query letters and cover letters. What I impress upon my staff is as we're going through the process of acquiring a manuscript for the year. Of course, the number one issue is quality. Because we're a teaching press, we have the ability to really put out the best book that we see. We don't have to worry as much about if something's going to be more popular, quote unquote. You know, we're looking for salability certainly, but we're certainly looking for quality first. So when we got to the final two, I'd say we came down to the final two relatively quickly, and the reason her book stood out. There's a line in Night Vision that I certainly attached to, and then when the students were talking about it, I said we have to find passages in each work that speak to us, or at least so the passages that I, or the chapters or stories I'd given them to read, I wanted to hear sort of passages. And the one that stood out was at the very end of Night Vision. The narrator says, she had a voice you could tie your boat to, which to us was a very significant moment. I said, books are all about moments. That's how books work. That's how they've always worked. A good book has a lot of moments. And for the first story to have such a profoundly poignant moment at the end of such a dark story really grabbed hold of me, and certainly grabbed hold of the staff, and they decided kind of right there.
Kim, I know you work a lot with developing writers, and so I wondered if this work with Cornerstone meant something to you for working with a teaching press.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because some writers might be a little uncomfortable with turning their book over to a group of undergraduate students. And I didn't have any of that trepidation, because I work with high school writers during the summertime, and I see what they're capable of at that young age. And, you know, I know that the people that are in this class and in this press, they would have been the kids that would have been at camp with me. So it's kind of like neat to see the future of what might former students might be doing.
And so let me turn back to Monica and Maddie and Katie and Ross as well. What is it that draws you to this end of the business?
This is Maddie Swanger, and I'm the director of operations. You know, we often joke in class and throughout the semester that, you know, we're all amateurs that are treated like experts, because none of us have any knowledge, or none of us had any knowledge of this business truly, like the ins and outs, before taking the class. So we're all kind of going in blind, but the beauty of the course is that, you know, it's okay that we're going in blind, because we all learn together. And this industry is one that you don't often get a chance to learn about, you know, the makings of it from start to finish, like, you know, acquisitions and then to final marketing and selling the book. And we all work together, and working with Kim especially has been so great, because she has been so open to this model, which, like she said, most authors probably wouldn't be, because at the end of the day, we are amateurs, and we are learning how to do this along with her. And, you know, it's a great opportunity for us to get a look into this industry that is so far out of our reach, because, you know, we're all from central Wisconsin. You know, we're not from New York or, you know, Chicago or these big cities where publishing is so big. So it's really great that this exists for us, where, you know, we probably wouldn't have the opportunity to have it.
And if I could interject here, too, it was such a wonderful experience seeing what the different editors found in my stories to make suggestions about, question, ask for clarification on. My circles, my writing circles, tend to be a little middle-aged and older. So to have these young people with a different perspective on the world bringing things to my attention in the stories, it was wonderful, and it actually was very validating, because, okay, it doesn't only play for old people. And they made my work better.
Well, and I wondered on the publisher end whether there's a certain amount of creative or artistic freedom that you bring to this without having the weight of, you know, years of sort of jaded New York decision making hanging over you, whether you can sort of come to this with fresher eyes.
Absolutely, we have freedom. We are able, as a small press, to do whatever the hell we want, and that's pretty nice. We do have a backlist. We published this. Kim's book is our 40th title since 1984. So we've kind of lived as this little secret. And so I've been here since 2016, and we've built a steady new model that allows for increased visibility, increased quality of design, of editing, of production, of marketing, of sales, but also increasing our kind of regional map. So Kim's book is our first Wisconsin book. And I talked, Kim was in town last week during, while the book is being printed at our local printer. And one of the things we talked about is, right now, New York City is not going to publish a book by a Midwestern writer about the Midwest, lest it has a very specific point of view. So something like Kim's book is going to be just completely ignored in the New York scene. I've got friends from the Midwest who've been trying to get collections and novels published for decades. And the same thing is told, their agents tell them the same thing. Well, a book about the Midwest isn't going to sell. And literally, this has been the case for, what, 50, 60 years? Yet, these voices need to be heard, and they need to be brought out. And we at the Cornerstone Press are able to to provide that platform for voices that deserve to be published. And so I consider it a democratization of the publishing process that a teaching press is able to create quality work and show larger industry standard folks that good writing happens everywhere. Okay, Monica?
Sure. Well, on that point, like, that's a huge thing for me. Having a platform and then being able to give that platform to someone with a voice that otherwise would be, you know, underground or experimental or underrepresented is so important. So becoming a part of the press and being able to become more active and decisive in that process has been so cool. And I want to draw back to what Kim was saying before we segued into this question. With editing, I think that both of us, I don't know, I can't speak for you, Kim, but we, on our end, we were really nervous. We didn't know, I think the copy editors at first and content editors, we were nervous because we didn't think we had the authority because we'd never done this before. And I think the same was true of you in the first edit where you weren't sure where to give us, you know, yes or no. It was kind of like, what do you think? And I think we finally broke the tension after the first few edits where it's like, all right, we're all on the same page here. We're not trying to hurt feelings. We're not trying to, you know, we were all learning in the process. And I think that was really neat, acknowledging that everyone was learning, whether it was us or Kim at your first book being published or your first short story collection being published.
Kim, does that jibe with what you remember?
It does. And I felt like, in a way, I almost had to give you guys permission to be the editors in some ways, because you gave me, I think, a little bit more input than other writers might have, which was wonderful. But I also wanted to empower you to make the decisions that editors need to make also. So I hope that it seems like we hit a nice medium in there.
Not too much bloodletting on either side.
Exactly.
Katie, what do you think?
This is Katie Nachumpasak, Chief of Staff for the Cornerstone Press. Basically, both Maddie and Monica's answers were what I was going to say, but I also want to add in that, like Monica said earlier, this whole process has been one giant learning process. Like, since day one of class, we've been thrown into the world of editing and publishing. And in my perspective, I think that's really amazing. Because I'm also an elementary education major, and I highly believe that all students should really be thrown into their fields to see, like, whether they like it or not, and to really gain that hands-on experience. So with the Cornerstone Press, this whole press is one giant hands-on experience. And if we didn't have this or any other student-run press at all, then how would you know whether or not, like, you would enjoy this world, because this is such a fascinating thing to be a part of.
So as we're having this conversation, there are several humanities programs at UW-Stevens Point that are facing the chopping block. Where do you think a program and an entity like Cornerstone Press fits in the discussion of the usefulness of the humanities at a school like Stevens Point?
Yeah, this is Ross Tangadol. I have plenty to say about this, so I'll keep it brief. Well, it's a double-edged sword, because my coursework here and curriculum represent sort of what you would call, quote-unquote, the practical side of humanities, which I think is a strange misnomer. I think there's an immense practicality to the humanities. It's been proven again and again by Forbes, Fortune 500 companies, how they're looking for certain skill sets, but not just skill sets, but how people navigate those skill sets in a very complex work environment. So with that caveat at the beginning, yes, programs like mine, it's the English department at a small regional comprehensive university, are under fire. People are afraid that, oh, well, what can people do with an English degree? What can people do with philosophy and history degrees? The key is the value of what we do in the Cornerstone Press. I have learned as a professor, I have learned more in 3 years from these people than I could have learned in any number of coursework as a student. It's amazing how much you have to learn and how fast you have to learn it. And frankly, it doesn't make sense that our university has this press. This press belongs at, Madison, Minnesota, Michigan. You know, you'd think a big state school would have a teaching press model like this, but no, we have it, and we're very proud of it. And all I would say to those that want to somehow cut the English degree at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, I've got an editor right now who went down to Florida and got herself a damn good job in South Florida working for a financial editing company, and she got that because she was editor-in-chief of my press. Okay? I'm sending 6 or 7 kids a year to graduate school for literary study, writing studies, some for publishing studies, because of their work in my department and in the Cornerstone Press. We are producing high-quality graduates with an immense amount of skill sets. And just because we're at a small public regional university doesn't mean we can't treat our students like they're going to Stanford or like they're going to Harvard. If we take away the opportunity for them to really be a part of something that only exists on the coasts and very sparingly throughout the Midwest in Minneapolis or Chicago, then we're losing. Everybody's losing.
I grew up 20 minutes away. I came to Stevens Point because I had no intentions in mind with what I was going to study. I think that finding the press is kind of like, you know, how people talk about falling in love with someone where you're kind of wandering and then all of a sudden they're there and it's like not, you know, it's you didn't plan it, you didn't go there for it, it just happened to you and it was kind of serendipitous. And who knew that 20 minutes away would be like where I would travel, you know, hours and states away to be, you know. I'm so lucky for that. And to have Warzala, the printing company, behind a supermarket, it's like a sleeping giant I never knew, you know. It's so serendipitous that I'm here and that this I have the press. Like, it's totally changed everything for me.
I just kind of go off of that. This is Maddie Swanger again. Not only with the press, obviously we are all very proud and of the work that we get to do with the press and everything that it has offered us, but the English professors to begin with and the department is, I truly believe that I could not have received the same education at like Madison or these big, you know, Big Ten universities, because I feel confident that I could go into any career, any industry and be confident in what I'll be doing because of everything I've learned in these courses and with these professors. And you know, it's not just like big lecture halls with hundreds of students. Like, we have classes with, you know, the most 24 students. And so you get an experience one-on-one with your professors that I would never have received anywhere else. And I'm very, very proud of the department and the professors here at this university. And they just sadly are not getting the recognition that they deserve.
This is Katie Nachapasak again. Like, the English department has changed my life, and English has always changed my life. Like, if I have to go back through all of my schooling, I'd have to say all of my English teachers were my biggest influences for me going into this world of editing and publishing, as well as education. And in my opinion, English and education is such an amazing blend because they both coincide together and they overlay in some sort of way. But if it weren't for the English department here in Stevens Point specifically, I would not be going on the career path that I'm going on right now. And because of all the English professors and everyone in the English department that I've met throughout my 3 years here, it's been such an amazing journey for me. So I'm forever grateful for that.
Kim, Monica, Maddie, Ross, and Katie, congratulations to all of you on this project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ross Tangadal is an assistant professor of English at UW-Stevens Point, and he's the director of Cornerstone Press. Monica Swinnick, Maddie Swanger, and Katie Nachapasak are all among the managers of the student-run press, which last month published Wisconsin writer Kim Suhr's collection of short fiction called Nothing to Lose.
One more break, and then we'll catch up with Wauwatosa native Grace Weber, whose new album will come out this year, the first since she signed a deal with Capitol Records. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Sometimes you just have a suspicion a person is going to go on to big things. Almost exactly 11 years ago, we interviewed an up-and-coming singer-songwriter who had just released her first CD.
At the time, Wauwatosa native Grace Weber was 19 years old, a student at NYU, and half of the artistic duo of Grace and Julian. And this is a taste of what that first album, also called Grace and Julian, sounded like.
I get down when I read your goodbyes, and I feel lost.
In the time since, Weber graduated from NYU, and she kept making music.
When you find out what you've been missing.
In recent years, she's worked with some accomplished musicians along the way, including Chance the Rapper, with whom she toured South America. And she founded a nonprofit here in Milwaukee to enhance music education opportunities for kids.
And then last year came along with maybe the brightest news yet, a recording contract with Capitol Records, which will put out her new album this year. Grace Weber was back home for the holidays and visited us again. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So I was thinking about the first time that you were on this show, and I think you were like a freshman or a sophomore in college. So then we look at where you are now. Do you wake up one morning and it hits you that you have gotten to the point that you have been working to all these years?
You know, I do allow myself that some days. I'm like, you know, I have to let myself celebrate that I've achieved this thing that I had always dreamed of, and like, wow, I really arrived at this point where I, you know, I signed a record deal with this legendary, iconic label. Like, I have to let myself celebrate that, because I think what I do sometimes is, okay, I've reached this point, now what's the next thing? And I don't let myself really enjoy the moment of patting myself on the back and being like, okay, cool, I did that. You know, let's pop open a bottle of champagne and toast to it. So I've been trying to let myself enjoy it.
Well, and you know, you think about it, and it's not necessarily like, you know, keeping it real and celebrating aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, you know, you can think about like these milestones along the way that you want to work towards without necessarily forgetting that there are still like other mileposts down the road, right?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to say it. And it's all about, you know, maintaining the balance of, okay, I'm really driven to keep going, doing what I want to do, and also realizing that there's never really a point that you ultimately arrive at in art. It's always just, and just in life, it's always, okay, now let's see what's around the next corner and let's just keep going.
The other thing that hits me as I was kind of trying to look back at everything you have done since we talked in whatever that was, 2007 and 2008, is just how many opportunities that you took advantage of between now, between then and now. Do you develop a philosophy when it comes to taking on collaborations and choosing the opportunities?
You know, for the most part, I've been really blessed with having cool opportunities. It's sort of like a breadcrumb is the way that I look at it. Like, you know, the universe sort of puts these little breadcrumbs in front of me like, okay, do this, keep going. This is going to lead you to the next thing. And as long as I have an attitude of curiosity and openness and wonder, usually whatever it is, whatever the opportunity is, whether it's something, you know, I've done things too that haven't really led me anywhere, or have been things that, you know, weren't the best experiences. But because I went into it with a vision of, okay, I'm just going to see what this teaches me, I always learn something from it, and then it, you know, has led me down the path that I'm on. When I was in high school, if you had told me, okay, you're not really going to start hitting your stride as far as knowing yourself as an artist, being kind of in your flow professionally until you're 30, I would have said, oh, no, no way. I'm going to give up before then. But that's what my path, you know, has been a journey of at each turn, I learned something that I would have never expected and helped me grow in a really big way and helped me become the artist that I am today. So
were there moments you thought of giving up?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. There's, you know, I think it was moments of wondering if the stress was worth it. You know, it's always these moments of like, oh, I'm so stressed about making it. But at every moment when I had those little blips of, okay, should I keep going? I would always ask myself, well, do I love singing? And the answer was yes. And then it was, okay, well, I can do this without the stress. I'm putting the stress on myself, deciding that I have to reach a certain level or hit this certain goal. I can just focus on the art and the music, you know, as long as I'm focused on why I love singing and getting on stage and sharing my voice with people, then again, it doesn't matter where I'm at. It's like I'm always doing what I love, and then then I'm happy.
When you talk about all these collaborations that you've done and people you've sung with and people have sung with you and opportunities you've had to do, you know, performances in kind of unusual places sometimes, is there a secret to doing all of these things and still coming out at the end of the day or end of the show or end of the album sounding like Grace Weber?
Yes. I think the secret is knowing yourself and really and learning when to say no to things. I always want to live under the sort of the year of yes, like Shonda Rhimes says, but when you really know yourself, you know what's gonna work for you as an artist. And I think that's when you really start hitting your stride. It's like, you know, this is my lane. This is what makes me happy. And also when you're collaborating with people, if you know yourself, your voice is always going to shine through no matter what the collaboration is. And so I think for me, it took me a little bit to feel that strength in being able to say, you know, this is who I am. This is the type of music that I love doing. These are my values. And these are the people that I want to align myself with. And really, for me, it came down to I want to make music with my friends, and I want to make music with people who bring me joy. And so when that is sort of your value, then it becomes easier to say no to things that don't bring you joy. Or like, you know, I don't really want to align myself with somebody who is bringing me down or isn't aligned with the value of love and light and all those things. So yeah, I think it's as long as you are very sturdy in who you are, no matter what you're doing, you're going to shine through.
I wonder if one of the lessons in growing up in this business is realizing that you can say no and people will continue to ask you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good way of saying it.
Talk a little bit about the record deal. I mean, I think many of us have this image in our mind of the record deal happening when some record company person is in the audience at a concert and then pulls the artist aside after they come off stage and says,
"Hey,
we
kid, with a big cigar in the mouth."
Exactly, and a contract that they're holding on to and a big check. I imagine that is not how the Capitol Records deal happened.
No. I mean, it was sort of magical a little bit in the sense it felt very right. Like it felt very much like the stars were aligning. Basically, we released, Binta and I, Binta's my manager, we released my first song off of the album called More Than Friends in November of last year. And we released it independently. And 2 weeks before we put it out, we decided we were putting it out. Like, we didn't have this huge, big plan. We just were cut. Binta was like, you know what? Let's put out More Than Friends. Like, that song's ready. Even though the rest of the album isn't finished, let's just put it out and see what happens. And it was both of us just kind of jumping in and trusting each other and trusting the universe and trusting that, okay, this is the right time. Let's do it.
Funny how it all came down. Funny how it all came down to this. Wondering where you are, leaving with a bad taste on your lips. What would you say to me if I was happily alone?
So we put out More Than Friends, and it hit this playlist called New Music Friday, which is a really big playlist, especially at the time on Spotify, and you know, it got millions of plays, and John Mayer randomly heard it and posted a screenshot of the song on his Instagram. Just like all these really cool things happened that were unexpected and fun. And Capitol, an A&R at Capitol named Aaron, ended up hearing More Than Friends on a playlist that wasn't even like a fancy discovery playlist. It was just sort of a random playlist that she was listening down to, heard More Than Friends, and emailed Binta the next day and said, you know, I really love this song, can we get on the phone? And actually a lot of labels reached out, but Aaron and Capitol, they were the only ones that seemed really focused on the music. You know, when Binta talked to Aaron, Aaron wasn't asking questions of like, oh, well, you know, who else is on the album? I heard she's collaborating with Chance, or it was none of that. It was just, you know, we love Grace. We love her voice. We love her music. Her music moves me. Like, I feel things when I listen to her music. And that's the type of, you know, those are the type of people that I want to work with on the business side, are people who are excited about the art and are excited about the way it makes them feel versus tracking the numbers of, okay, well, how many, you know, Instagram followers does she have? Or, and so there was, the way that the conversation was going was really resonating with us. And then the head of A&R at Capitol did come out to a show. It was interesting. I felt more relaxed that he was in the room.
You knew he was there.
Yeah, and I felt like a sense of, kind of like when you have like a mentor or a, I don't even know why I felt like this, but I felt, when he walked into the room, I felt more calm. From then, you know, it was just a process of figuring out the deal. And then when I went in to sign, I got to, you know, walk into the Capitol Records building with the big tower and...
In Hollywood,
and, you know, signed the paperwork, and then they had a bottle of champagne, and we went to the roof, and they gave me a tote bag and a T-shirt.
It must have been just a little bit surreal.
It was. It was surreal. There were cupcakes. And it also felt really normal. I think that's the other thing that I like about Capitol is, like, all the people that work there are really cool. You know, it feels like friends. You know, it's just, there's a real sense of community and support. Like, I got to meet a group of other women who were signed that year as well. A few weeks later, I did this thing with five other women who were recently signed, and I got to meet them, and they were all so cool, and it just felt like this real sense of camaraderie and, you know, no competition, just kind of like, oh, cool, like, we're all experiencing this together and getting to talk about, you know, okay, well, what's it like for you? What's it like for you? And but the people on my team at Capitol are also just so cool. I was also just surprised how, like, everyone's just super down to earth. It's been a really good journey so far, and I'm just trying to keep reminding myself, like, just take it a day at a time. Keep having fun. Don't, you know, I have to journal a lot about not getting in my head. I tend to overthink things, and I do compare myself a lot to other musicians and artists who I'm friends with or who I look up to, and, oh, you know, am I not, you know, doing enough because I'm not getting enough likes on this post? You know, I struggle with all that stuff, and I have to remind myself to keep, like I said before, recalibrating my compass and remember what's important. And then, and again, like you said, honestly, celebrating the Capitol thing helps me recalibrate it, too, in a way of, like, you know what? Let me just enjoy this for a second. And my album is done, so I've been enjoying that. And really, like, enjoying the moment, which sounds cliche, but, hey, it's the truth. What do you see?
What do you see? Did Mercy come out before you signed the deal or after?
After, yeah.
So do you feel when you put out a single after you sign a record deal that is there more pressure in the success or failure of a particular song when you've got the backing of a label behind you?
I put more pressure on myself, which was interesting. Like, it was a really eye-opening experience because Capitol... they seemed almost happier than I was. I was like, oh, well, shouldn't it be doing more? Should we get more plays? And they were like, congratulations, this is great. You know, we're so happy. So, but they didn't put the pressure on me. I actually kind of put the pressure on myself. So I've really been trying to process that. Like, okay, cool, this is interesting. Like, there isn't as much pressure as I thought there would be. There is definitely things that are different. Like, you know, I'm trying to find the balance between, I've been doing this by myself for so long. Well, with Binta. But as far as the two of us really crafting every single release and, you know, every cover that we do is just like I ask my friend who's an artist to help me out, or my buddy who's a graphic designer to do this, or, my brother helped me make the website. And now it's like, you know, the website needs to get cleared by, like, a whole legal team to make sure that, you know, there's a lot more people. There's like 40 people, you know, versus two.
The Grace Weber entourage.
Yeah, it's like a whole new, and you have to really learn the balance of realizing that all these new people on your team want to be involved just as much as, you know, they want to feel excited about the process, and you have to let them into the process and not be afraid of, having to control everything and being so precious about everything, but still maintaining your artistry. So it's just this balance of, okay, you know, I can, like, let you in, plus I can still be, like, guiding the ship. So far it's been a really beautiful experience, and I also get access to work with all these new artists and, you know, the person who I'm going to be working with to shoot my album cover. This is probably way too TMI, but oh well. Well, not TMI. It's just we're not releasing all the info yet. So I'll just say photographer who's shooting my album cover is this really amazing artist that I probably would have never gotten to work with if not for signing. So I get access to all these really cool things and kind of like keeping it all in the family while also extending the family.
So the album is done.
Yes.
Does Capitol become any part of the creative process, or it's done, and they sign off on it?
Well, the beautiful thing about this was the album was done when we signed the deal. I mean, we had a couple little pieces that we still had to fill in, but the idea was that Binta and I were going to finish. Binta's the executive producer of the album as well, so that we were going to finish all those little details ourselves, and Capitol's been really supportive in helping us finish, but we really, you know, all the creative of this album was ours and was mine and done. And so it was a cool experience of Capitol hearing the album and, you know, signing off before I even signed. So then it was a feeling of like, okay, cool. They really like me for who I am. They love the album. They don't want to change anything. They don't want to change me. They love, you know, my style, my fashion, the art, the covers, like everything about me. They were like, you're great, you're cool. And it's a very refreshing feeling of like, you sure I don't have to do a tap dance? Or it's just kind of like, no, we think you're dope. And so, yeah, the album was done and we just mastered it. So now we're just going on the journey of releasing it and I'm pretty excited.
Grace Weber, thank you so much. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What do you see?
Wauwatosa native and Pius High School alum Grace Weber signed a deal with Capitol Records last fall. The new album will be out this year, but there are already several tracks available, and you can find a link to them from WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.